You're listening to A Stranger Podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hello, listener. Thank you for downloading yet another Dear Science podcast. I am Jonathan Golub, the science stringer here at The Stranger, and with me today is Eli Sanders, senior writer for The Stranger.
Hello.
Hello, Eli. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a little bit of a hiatus. I actually had to do science in the meantime, but I thank you for your patience. And today we're going to talk about eugenics, a nice light topic, something to really break the ice again, really something you should bring up at every different dinner party that you go to. What do you feel about eugenics? Eli, what do you feel about eugenics? Do you think this is a pro or con eugenics at this point?
Well, first of all, I'm flattered to have been, you know, obviously eugenically selected out of the stranger pool to discuss today. but the thing that I think about these days with eugenics is all the talk about gays in the womb. Now that, you know, science is maybe getting closer to figuring out whether there's a gay gene and what it might be, the Christian right is very sort of excited about this opportunity to nip us in the womb, so to speak.
I absolutely. In fact, I mean, maybe even that's maybe in the future. One of the things that's actually coming up right now that's causing some demographic grief is that right now with current technology, it's relatively easy to weed out girls. So you can go to a clinic and you can actually select out sperm with a Y chromosome as opposed to an X chromosome, because X chromosome is bigger than Y chromosome. You have a big centrifuge. You take the sperm, spin it out, and take the light sperm. And then if you can have only male babies if you wanted. And this is coming up. And in fact, you can actually see this, in, particularly in China, because of the one-child policy. Parents will actually pay to guarantee their one child, or have a very good chance of their one child being being male. And the gay gene, there's been a couple of really interesting papers that have come out. One was in worms, and I'm not sure how relevant that is to people. Worms have the C. elegans worm that they use for these studies. And it's a great genetic model, but you can actually count the number of cells in it. Like, every worm has exactly, and I think it's 129 cells. There are gay worms, and there are gay...
Add that to the list. I knew there were gay penguins and gay sperm whales, which seems appropriate, but
I think
worms.
Every creature, pretty much, you can find it. And in worms, and strictly speaking, worms don't come in male and female. I think they come in hermaphrodites or female. I think that's pretty much the choices you get. But you can muck around with them genetically and cause them all to be, you know, like mate in inappropriate ways or non-procreative ways. And that, I think that was what they were saying is a surrogate for gay 129 cell beasts. And I'm really not so sure how relevant it is. But there is another study, I think, in sheep where they were doing this, kind of trying to narrow it down.
See, what I always wonder is how you scientists feel about making this easier, this sort of practice of eugenics.
I think usually what I end up saying with this sort of thing is, I think most scientists are sort of almost libertarian in the attitude, where they're like, it's an interesting question, and so they'll go after it. It's a complex trait, but it's relatively easy to define in sort of a yes-no way, and I think they pick it mostly because it's a problem. As far as sort of the ethical qualms, the few authors that have been on this have actually said sort of the inverse. Their attitude is more like, there's a biological basis for gay. Like, this isn't just like a made-up thing done by the Bravo TV network to try to, you know, coerce the youth into evil behaviors. Like, there's an actual biological basis, and then it gets turned on its head where they're like, oh, now we can cure it.
Right. Well, or take it beyond gays. I mean, you know, the more you end up identifying through science in terms of gene expression and what someone is destined to be like, the more you'll be able to select out for California girls or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think most of the things that people are initially looking at are more things like illness. So like, there are big traits that you can come up with. And so, for example, there's a scientist at University of Washington who's very famous for coming up with a few mutated genes that are greatly increase the chance of breast cancer. I'll go through the story really briefly. They looked for families where men got breast cancer, right? Figuring if the men in the family...
That was possible.
It's possible. In fact, there's an increasing incidence of it due to obesity. This study was done, you know, decades ago when this wasn't as big of a deal. But yeah, you get obese enough, you have enough estrogen, males can have breast cancer.
Why isn't that part of the public health campaign against obesity?
Not
only will you get breasts, you'll be a higher percentage chance of getting breast cancer.
It's still very low, but I agree. It would be a great poster, you know, like, for thing. But it's actually Ashkenazi Jewish family. So the other thing, like, you have to find like really like narrow little groups of people who lived in little islands, whether real islands or virtual islands,
because of Ashkenazi Jews with who are men with breasts are more likely to get.
I mean, so in these families, actually, it wasn't the men weren't necessarily obese. Even non-obese men in these families got breast cancer. So the women tend to get breast cancer in like their 30s, young, and then the men would get it in later on in life when testosterone levels drop and blah, 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 blah. And by looking at these families, they found the BRCA1 and 2 genes, the breast cancer 1 and 2 genes. And now you can go, you can pay, get this test done, and if you think you're at risk for it, and if you come up positive for the mutated genes, they actually recommend to some women, at least, to consider getting a preemptive mastectomy. Have their, before they kind of hit the age where it's very likely to have a mastectomy, even before, just assume you're going to get breast cancer, most likely if you have these particular mutants, and then you go back. And so, of course, you know, so this is one of the cases where I think where scientists sort of focus on something where there's like maybe a chance to actually save a life or whatever else, but...
Traumatize a generation of Ashkenazi Jews.
Exactly. Also. Everything's an Ashkenazi Jews. This is like, you know, this is the, I don't know if you know this, but the Human Genome Project, right, where they sequence all the human genomes, and there was a very, the government-funded NIH thing, they picked a panel of all these different races, carefully balanced, trying to get a broad cross-section of the American population. And then there was Craig Venter at his company, Celera, private company. And you know who he used as his reference genome?
The Ashkenazi Jews?
Himself, specifically, right? So there's a gross overrepresentation of Ashkenazi Jew in the consensus human genome. And to add a little bit better to his, almost all of the Bush-approved human embryonic stem cell lines, the ones that are made before the August 2001 cutoff date, all pretty much from the same in vitro fertilization clinic in Tel Aviv. So this is something you can chew on as far as Ashkenazi Jews' contribution to science and rolling this maybe into a little bit of the eugenics and all the rest of it here. But
a second Holocaust if you do away with these stem cells?
I feel kind of good about it. I actually worry, you know, I'm Ashkenazi Jew. I'm a little worried about, you know, I don't want to be that genetically close to many embryonic stem cells because in case I kind of prick myself with the needle, I'd really rather not have them growing in me. But beyond that, I don't know. I mean, it's good for the Jews, I think, overall. But others might have different attitudes. I kind of do appreciate that Bush decided it was okay for these embryos to be destroyed.
I think this is bad for our hypochondria, actually.
I think I would agree to go through all this. Well, it's not just Jews, though. The other big group of ethnic group that has been used in these studies is Icelandic people. The government of Iceland has sold the genetic stock of Iceland as, like, you know, little Scandinavians get on the boats and grow across the sea, and they end up on a little island, a little genetically isolated population. That's really the key to get the nice genes to sort of bubble up, where you get like nice defined groups where you can find like a family where the men get breast cancer, right? You need to kind of have just that, not quite inbreeding, but a little bit of more interconnectedness than you probably would find in a lot of other populations. And so the Icelandic people were a little bit smarter and actually sold this, however. And so the governor of Iceland is viewed this as a revenue generating enterprise. But to be honest, you know,
maybe the Ashkenazi Jews can do something similar to what's been done with the plundered art. We can get some money for a plundered gene sometime in the future.
Try to recover.
Yeah.
Well, so, but as you're kind of getting a sense of it, it's tricky to do these studies in people. People are tremendously outbred and all mixed, and it's very hard to find studies like this. So where they're actually trying to identify alleles. And so I'm going to take just a brief didactic moment here to describe what we're talking about. So genes, you can think of like dishes, like you're going to make like a dinner party, like a dishes, you have like pancakes, whereas alleles are the actual recipes to make the dishes, and you get two of each of them. And so really what we're talking about is tracking bad alleles, bad recipes for a given dish the body has to make. So blah, blah, blah. So you want to identify good and bad alleles, or alleles at least with a trait, maybe not a pointing thing. And so hard to do it in people. So you need a bunch of different, you need an organism that where there's a lot of different varieties, all of which can interbreed with one another, and that's pretty much dogs. Dogs are one of the few creatures on the planet that have a similar population to humans where it's all over the place. So, like, you know, think about it. In theory, you could put a Chihuahua and a Great Dane together and get puppies, and you would probably want to use a male Chihuahua and a female Great Dane and assist this a little bit. The reverse would be more like, you know, Alien rather than Gattaca, but in theory...
He's drawing pictures right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I am.
For those really of you listening at home.
Visual image here for everyone. But you can make puppies with that, right? And so if you want to know the alleles it takes to make a big dog versus a little dog, and conversely, thanks to evolution, we believe in evolution here at The Stranger. I'm going to let you, I'm just going to endorse endorse evolution, go out here on thing here. Because of evolution, the alleles that are present in dogs, you can mix and match them up with the alleles that are present in the human population. And so you have your Great Dane, you look at all the alleles that the Great Dane has, you look at all the alleles the Chihuahua has, and you start getting a sense of which ones are for big dogs and which are for little dogs. But if you really want to nail it down, you do the infamous pairing of Chihuahua and Great Dane, make some puppies, then take those puppies and breed them either back with Great Danes or Chihuahuas. And then you with the way the deck shuffle, right? So the first generation of puppies will have one allele from Great Dane and one allele from a Chihuahua. And then the second generation, if you go back, you start narrowing down to cutting back the number of alleles that are present. You're making an artificial family. And then you'll find, okay, some of these puppies are big, some of these puppies are small in the second or third or fourth generation. You'll be able to figure out back from there what allele follows with it. And that's, there's a couple groups that are doing exactly that, using dog breeds and particularly these rare mutts, both individual separate breeds and then rare mutts, try to work out things. So I think a lot of people have like labs, and the labs tend to have hip problems. And so they're trying to find the alleles associated with hip problems, or there are certain dogs that are a little neurotic or kind of mean-tempered and try to go and find that. And so...
So if you bred, say, your guest Charles Medede with Britney Spears after a couple generations, you could get separate epigenes for yeah. Marxism and shallowness.
Yeah, Cheeto eating. I think you could probably solve both of those problems with a great deal of success by doing that. But you can't really do that with people. I don't think that would be ethical.
Well, this is my question, though. I mean, that's where this is going, right? That's the end result of all this. Otherwise, what's the point?
I mean, you could make an argument that there are... What the people in the field will say to you is, well, if we can, you go and get your readout, you find out all the alleles, we have them associated, and you're like, oh, you're going to have heart problems. Let's put you on heart medications now rather than wait later. Or like, we know that this allele, this problematic allele responds really well to this drug. So the idea is to make it like more automatic. Like you get in and read the test and like you get a list of pills back you should be taking to live till 90 and have a glorious, happy life. That's the sell right now. As you kind of alluded to at the beginning, it's very likely that it will be used for exactly what you're talking about, to weed out undesirable characteristics in your offspring. I mean, this is like the plot of Gattaca. And when it comes down to it, the plot of Gattaca is pretty much nonfiction now. I mean, the last thing is identifying what all these alleles mean. And we just laboriously talk through about how that get done. But everything else in that movie is pretty much nonfiction now. And just for people who haven't seen this movie, and you should see the movie, it's a fantastic movie. The basic premise of it is that you go into a geneticist clinic, then you combine your eggs and sperm in a dish, and then you read out genetically of all your candidate embryos what sort of alleles they have and pick the best one. You know, I think the line in the movie is the best of both of you, and then you implant that embryo, it grows up, and you have a wonderful genius child who's 8 foot tall and looks like Jude Law and God knows what. So So this is the general premise behind the movie, and all of that's true, and all that's possible right now. So you can in vitro fertilization, no problem. Routinely done in basically an unregulated industry, just to kind of tweak you along, a very profitable industry at that. You fertilize the egg, it grows through about 8 cells, a solid ball, and then about 150 cells, and then it stops growing in the dish and you have to implant it. And at either of those stages, you pluck a cell or two away from the embryo. You can freeze back the whole embryo, the embryo won't miss those missing cells, you can grow up those cells to make something called fibroblast and collect DNA from them. So no problem, you can get the DNA right now, nonfiction, with current technology, and grow up, easily get DNA from each individual embryo. You can then go on to take that DNA, and there are a couple different ways to deal with it. Probably the two most likely, one is something called single nucleotide polymorphism microarrays, which is a way of blah 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 to look through. I'm not even going to try without diagrams and making you all go to sleep to explain how this works, but you can read out many of the different alleles. Certainly there are arrays like this designed where you can tell you have the breast cancer gene allele, or you don't, or you have, you know, the few that have already been identified and many, many others. And the last thing, the brute force technique, is you just read the entire sequence of DNA. You go right through from the start of the chromosomes to the end of the chromosomes, and you find out every single base pair of DNA that you have in that embryo. And that used to cost $1 per base pair, and there are 3 billion base pairs or so in the human genome. So it was a little out of the budget of most people, except for Craig Venter, because, you know, he's just that awesome. But it's coming down really rapidly. It's coming down to more like $1,000 per genome, per embryo, whatever you want to do.
And would you do this personally if you were having kids? Or more current, does this help you in your dating life? Have you sequenced yourself and you can
I'm a little horrified to imagine what I think I'm extraordinary in good and bad ways. I imagine my genetic sequence, looking at my family and the general rest of it. But I don't know if I would use it. I'm too big of a cynic. I think, as great as it made it sound to identify what all these alleles mean, I think there's going to be a lot of uncertainty, because it's not just, I don't think it's that reductionist. It's the interaction. It's the whole soup that makes up an individual person. This is why, you know, sometimes we kind of do that too. You see, like, you put two people together and you end up with a baby. They're like, how did that kid come from them? Half the time you're like, oh, it's a perfect match of them, personality, temperament-wise, all this stuff. And the other time you're like, something kind of didn't happen here, right? And that sometimes is just the complex interaction of alleles. And I mean, this gets into, like, you know, if you ask me point blank, do I think there's going to be like a gay gene, a single gene? No way. Do I think there's going to be a subset of genes? There might be some that tip maybe a little bit more in favor of it, because there, you can, like, I can think of a couple families that I know where, like, you know, like, the parents got together and all of their kids are queer, like, all the way up and down. And it's sort of like you begin to wonder in that sort of family, and like, you go to their cousins in the third order, maybe that's the kind of family you maybe would find it.
And twins are more likely to be gay if one of them is gay, and also isn't it the later children are more likely to be gay? I don't understand how that connects to what you're describing.
But there's a good segue exactly what I'm trying to say.
Also, I'm the oldest child in my family. I'm gay, my brother's not, so explain that.
I'm gonna try my best. So, like, it's a lot of things, like twins, where I think about twins, identical twins share the genetic sequence, but they also share the time in the womb. And so one of the ideas why each subsequent male birth is statistically more likely to be gay is that the mother, who has not seen that volume of testosterone, the immune system begins to react to testosterone. And so each subsequent male child has less and less testosterone. And so, and at that little itty bitty narrow window in development, they think, which determines sort of like sexuality and gender identity, like, don't get quite enough testosterone with each male birth because the mother is sort of suppressing the levels of testosterone. That's one of the hypotheses.
Just for gay male children?
Gay male children. And then there's,
so how do you explain lesbians? And are lesbians more likely to be the oldest daughter?
I don't know that. I don't know that data. I mean, like a lot of fields in science, I think women were discovered 20 years ago by the scientists. And so I don't know if that's quite as far ahead. But you can, I think, certainly androgen exposure. So getting testosterone in a female fetus can tip things a little bit at the right time. And I think this is where a lot of the animal studies and some of the other things that have been worked out have come out to say. But I don't know. So I guess that's a whole long way of saying, like, genes kind of fall in there a little bit, but so does, like, all the stuff that sort of happens during development. I mean, and so...
This is another part of this that I don't get. You always hear today, you know, we think we're making a breakthrough in discovering the gene for anxiety, but mm-hmm. it's a complex interplay between the genetic expression and the environmental experience. Mm-hmm. And if it's taken us this long to figure out the gene or the couple of genes that might have something to do with this type of personality, say, or this type of illness or this type of physical presentation of a human being, how are we ever going to figure out the complex of environmental factors that combine in the right way with this gene to produce this result? And if you can't ever figure that out, then who cares?
Well, and I think you put your finger on it. And I think this is why, again, where I think the scientists have tended, despite all the grandiose talk, tended to focus on things with where the genes are quite strong in pushing for it. And focusing on those traits first. So things like I said, like the breast cancer gene. Or, I mean, another example of another one where genes probably have a stronger effect than the environment would be like cholesterol. Like, you know, if you have, like, I have, again, in my wonderful collection of alleles, I have, both my parents have high cholesterol. I was, like, guaranteed, I could be eating, you know, like, celery and wheatgrass for the rest of my life. And
are we both Ashkenazi Jews?
I think so.
I've got another Ashkenazi Jew example. My 99-year-old great aunt, who lives a couple blocks away from here, smoked all her life, eats nothing but rich foods, skinny, older than anyone in my family, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera.
It totally happened. In fact, there's one of the other things they've identified now. It's another pair of alleles. They can, right now, there's a couple things you can check for. You can tell you if you're smoking, if you have these kind of alleles, you're much more likely to get emphysema, or you're much less like, and they have a little bit less of a sense, but getting a sense of what sort of alleles you have to get lung cancer. So there are people, if you have the right genetic deck, you can probably smoke till you're 99 and live a glorious, happy life, and you have the bad, you know, the bad alleles, you end up, you know, getting emphysema at 50. And
she also
and
got the gene for complaining. So I don't know if she's lived. She's lived a nice, happy life.
I'm trying to think, you know, there's another gene, the gene for hairy ears and nose, I think also tracked with Ashkenazi Jews. It's the only, get this, this is the
that one will make you money, especially on nighttime television, among nighttime television watchers. You should start advertising that now, in fact.
So get this, that gene is, I think, the only gene that is male linked beyond, of course, like the male gene. There's two genes. One is actually makes all the male characteristics on the Y chromosome. The other one is for hairy ears and nose. Everything else is like it's on the X chromosome or like whatever. This is the major contribution to the Y chromosome to the human panoply is hairy ears and nose and testicles, I guess. Pretty much the thing. So I don't know. I Ashkenazi Jews really guess have made great strides for our fields here.
The theory of relativity and hairy ears and testicles. You know, that's something to be proud of. Any marginalized ethnic group would love to contribute to that.
Really, I'm swelling with pride right now. I feel like we've really done well for the world. I think this is probably a good place as any to stop. Thank you very much, Eli, for coming in.
Thanks for explaining this to me.
I've enjoyed it very much. Please keep sending your questions in to dearscience@thestranger.com. I'd like to thank the Tech Savvy Youth, and we'll see you back in a couple weeks.